What a great presentation we just heard. I hope everyone was here in the room for Peter Shankman's really motivating and inspiring talk. I know that we all walked away with some great nuggets. I'm Karen Kuttner. I'm with Lindblad Expeditions, and we're going to talk today about the changing world of the educational travel market as it relates to the economy. And it is so incredibly timely, and I think that we'll find it to be really interesting because we're taking a look today at the current landscape. Where are we? What does it look like? And we're going to take a forward look into the outlook of where are we going? What does the travel industry look like? And then more specifically, what does our world, our niche, our affinity travel look like in the coming year, perhaps 2 years, as it relates to everything we're all sort of seeing in the news and experiencing around us? We recognize that these are really uncertain times. There are a lot of different risk factors from economic and social and political risks that we're all realizing. And we're going to take a look today. One of the goals will be to take a look today and understand the link and the likely connection between what's going on in the world around us every time we open up the news or open up and listen to the radio or however we choose to listen to news, as Peter Shankman says. And we're going to then take a look and say, how do we put this into the context of where we are going and how does it look for our future? I know almost everybody here in the room in some way or the other operates trips or offers programs in certain parts of the world that are currently on somewhat of a list of, you know, how do we operate? Are we going to operate in places like Cuba or in Mexico or in Russia? Or perhaps the list continues to go on and on for those operating in Iran and other places as well. And so what we want to do today is take a look first to get kind of a layman's view from our expert on hand of kind of the big picture landscape of how the economy and political world will play a role and impact our lives, and then kind of look more specifically at questions that have been pressing on all of our minds. For example, what does this mean for our future? How does the currency play a role? What about the uncertainties in U.S. tensions? How do walls play a role in our future, if there are any? So we have lots and lots to take a look at, and while the picture may be a little bit hazy today, the one thing we do keep hearing, no matter where we go and what we're literally seeing, is change is coming. For those of you that have read some of the trade last week, or you know, even maybe 2 weeks ago now, Asta's vice president of communication just, you know, said that really the travel ban, even though, you know, there's been lots of information about it and a lot of shifting going on, that said it's had a chilling effect. But what does that mean for our world? And how can we decipher that? And so I am so pleased that today we're able to bring in an expert on hand. And I'm delighted to introduce you to Art Goldsmith. He is a faculty member at Washington and Lee. And thanks to Rob Fury, director of special programs, he had the vision and the foresight to bring Art's name and Art's background and expertise to us. And he will be, Art has combined a very unique combination in the classroom of sociology and psychology and economy into the experience to help us decipher really what's happening in the world of travel and other industries as well. He's an author. You will have seen some of his work, and I'll share that with you, in a number of professional art journals, from the Journal of Economics Literature, Economic Perspectives, Journal of Human Resources, Economic Inquiry, Southern Economic Journal, Economic Behavior and Organization, and more. So to give you a sense, he's well-equipped to join us today. The way it's going to work is we'll share, and we'll have an opportunity to a little bit you know, hear from Art for about 30 minutes or so, and he'll kind of lay the groundwork for us. And then we'll have an opportunity, to, a good 30, 35 minutes, to open it up for questions and answers. So this is really an opportunity, hopefully, for all of you to think through as you're, you may already have questions, but hopefully you'll also gain some questions by the types of things that Art shares with us today that we can then open it up to the room to really address. We'll also have two respondents in the room, and the first person is Joe Small, who's right here raising his hand, president of Alumni Holidays, and he'll represent a question that may pertain to things that we hear in the presentation as it relates to the destinations, operators, and supplier perspective. And we also have Joan Russell in the room, and she's waving her hand right here. And she'll be there. And she, also a seasoned veteran like Joe, will be sharing. She's the Vice President of World Affairs Council, and she'll add a perspective somewhere along the line as well on from a planner standpoint. And so we'll see as we go along, you know, what will strike each person. So without further ado, I'd love to introduce you with a warm welcome, Art Goldsmith.
Thank you very much, Karen. And I want to thank Abby and Heidi and Karen and Shirley Rob Fury for both organizing this session today on education, travel in a changing world, but also for inviting me to join you this morning. And I want to begin by just saying how important and valued the work that all of you are doing is. I constantly hear from alums at my institution about how enriching it is when they go on these tours that are arranged and serviced by your organizations, because it connects them with the university again, and it also reconnects them with long-lost friends in many occasions. Traveling together is really special for them. So what I'd like to do today is just give you a framework to think about your industry in the next few years, and Trump has certainly created a bit of a stir, and then we can open it up to questions and see where we can go together. I'm going to focus on international travel programs, not so much domestic things. I want to talk to you a little bit about the demand side of your business, and then I want to spend some time paying particular attention to the economic outlook for the next few years and what that means for your industry. But also, I want to spend some time talking with you about uncertainty, because uncertainty is certainly going to play a critical role in the kinds of programs that you plan and the ways in which you do that. So, it wouldn't surprise you to know that economists, when they look at the travel industry, see a demand for travel. And a demand curve is nothing more than the relationship between the price of something and the quantity that people want to buy of that. And that demand curve for almost every good is downward sloping, which means when price falls, quantity demanded rises. There are some snob goods. Maybe if you're playing golf and you go into the golf shop and you want to get a golf ball and they say, well, we got cheap ones and expensive ones, you might say, well, I'll take the expensive ones, right? You might say that. But for most goods, price down, quantity demanded up, or the other way around. And your industry is no different in that sense. In fact, there's been lots of studies by empirical studies by economists, and generally speaking, if prices go up about 10%, we see the quantity demanded of travel falling by around 6%. So there is a relationship there. Now, I have to tell you that economists give names to everything. That's one of the ways we stay employed. And we call the relationship between price and quantity demanded, that degree of sensitivity is called elasticity, which sounds really kind of daunting and mysterious. But you can think of it in two ways. Sometimes that relationship is really sensitive. Price down, huge increase in quantity demanded, or price up, huge decline in quantity demanded. We call that elastic. And in your business, you see relationships that are elastic when there are substitutes. So if we're thinking about, oh, I just got to get away from winter, I need some sunshine, it doesn't matter to me whether it's Belize or the Caribbean, you might call that sunlust. That's a pretty elastic relationship. If the price falls, the quantity demanded is going to increase a lot. But there are other kinds of travel which you could think of as wanderlust. that's I have to see Constantinople or Jerusalem or Vancouver or something, and nothing else is going to do, that's not going to be so price sensitive. We would call that inelastic. Changes in price have small changes in quantity demanded. And for much of the work that you all do, you're in that wanderlust part of it, and that's probably a good thing. Now, when we talk about demand and the relationship between price and quantity demanded, we're doing that holding everything else that influences travel constant. And those everything else's turn out to be real important, or what we call demand shifters. And there are, I would say, three traditionally big demand shifters when you think about something like travel. And that would be people's disposable income. That would be their financial wealth positions or holding of stocks and bonds and bank accounts. Now, lots of people think they also have wealth in the form of like skateboards in the garage from their kids or Velvet Elvises and stuff, but they're not all that liquid. So we're talking about liquid wealth here. And of course, safety or security. And anytime income is rising or safety is improving or wealth is increasing, you would expect at any price the quantity demanded of travel to rise. And I want to say something about each of those in just a moment. But there might be a big fourth, given that you all deal with international travel, and that's exchange rates. And I have to tell you, of all the things you teach in economics, this is the one that students are more likely to get backwards than anything else, right? Exchange rates, here we're talking about the value of the dollar here for a second, right? Which is really the strength of the dollar is the number of units of another currency it takes to fetch $1. If it takes bushel baskets of another currency to fetch a single dollar, the dollar is stronger, and that means that when folks from the U.S. go to travel overseas, goods look relatively cheap. And this is really important. Two things I want to make sure you're aware of is that the value of the dollar is very sensitive to the interest rate in the United States, and it's very sensitive to profit expectations. Two things that are going to be moving around here in the next few years, and I want to help you understand that. When U.S. interest rates are rising, savers around the world are thinking to themselves, I'd rather lend in the United States and take advantage of that higher interest rate. Well, that's a two-step process. First, they save. Then they have to change their savings into dollars. They're demanding dollars so that they can then essentially loan that money in the United States by buying an IOU or what we call a bond, right? So when interest rates in the U.S. are going up, they're going to be buying more dollars. That's going to be increasing the strength or the value of the dollar and making foreign travel cheaper. And I'm going to suggest to you that the interest rate is probably going to be going up here in the next, in the near term. Second thing is when U.S. firms are more profitable, then entrepreneurs around the world want to buy pieces of those U.S. firms. To do that, first they have to buy dollars, then they buy those pieces, and again, the value of the dollar would be rising. And that's going to help you if your clientele is looking to travel internationally. So when the dollar's stronger, that demand for travel is shifting out. We've estimated that relationship. And it's a pretty sensitive one. A 10% increase in income in most developed nations leads to around a 13% increase in foreign travel. So that's something to be aware of as we talk about the economy and the value of the dollar moving forward. Here's a little data. Shows you you can see the value of the dollar rising a little bit, kind of like a mild slope upward there. And the lower picture is U.S. folk traveling to Canada, right? And you can see that the dollar's stronger, more folks in the U.S. are traveling to Canada. I could do that for many, many countries, right? That's the relationship. So it's real. It does matter. Okay. Other things, aside from these four factors, income, wealth, right, safety, value of the currency, also influence travel. I just want to briefly mention some of those. I'm just going to put them into one big bucket together. Certainly the price of substitutes. If staycations become cheaper, right, because there are sales on those, then the demand for foreign travel will fall. That's a substitute, but I think this compliments is something you should spend a little time thinking about, and the big player there currently is Airbnb, right? Airbnb is making foreign travel for lots of folks cheaper because the cost of hotel rooms is essentially falling. There's a lot more competition there, and when the price of compliments are falling, if it's cheaper to park at a football stadium, more people buy football tickets, Airbnb has been having a positive impact on foreign travel. On the other hand, a big factor in travel is airline costs. I've noticed that in a bunch of studies that a 10% increase in airline fees results in about a 15% reduction in travel. So that's something to keep your eye on, what's happening to flights. As they go up, that's not a good thing for your industry. And then, of course, there's this amorphous thing called taste for travel. That comes from many, many different avenues. It certainly has to do with education, prior experience, things of that nature. I know I raised my kids about a third of their lives until they went off to college in Australia in the Gold Coast. And they're always telling me about where they're going, where they've been, where they want to go next, and if I could just throw them a few bucks, right? They have strong tastes for travel, and they could probably attribute that to their mom, right? Safety. Let me say something about safety for a second. This is a good example up here. That's showing receipts to visit Turkey, expenditures, total number of visitors is the orange line there to Turkey. We know that their travel industry got shocked in the last year or so by some terrorist acts in the airport there. And look at what's happened to travel there. It really fell off. So security, it is an issue. I could have shown you a picture for Paris. It looks pretty similar, right? So as you're moving forward in your industry, you want to be thinking about those places where people do want to go. They have some wanderlust, but at the same time, they're comfortable that it's safe, right? And that, you know, that's where your experience and your expertise is going to play a role. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if in the current environment, travel to Costa Rica and Belize and places like that, Australia, New Zealand, that would probably be increasing because those are interesting places to go. And nobody's going to say, geez, I'm really worried, you know, that I'm going to be eaten by the Maori or, you know, that I'm going to disappear in Belize or something like that, right? So not every one of those factors that influences the demand for travel is equal. Some are more special than others. And I have to tell you, you know this, income really rules the roost. It is by far the strongest factor in terms of determining the level of international travel that takes place. And the best study that I could share with you shows that if you look at the OECD countries, the 18 sort of wealthy developed countries of the world, in those countries, on average, a 10% increase in income results in about a 16.5% increase in travel outside of the country by their residents. Now, in economics, we think of three kinds of relationships between income and spending on goods and services. One is called inferior goods. So if GNP were to rise by 10%, and spending on a good or service were to fall, we call that an inferior good. And those, it doesn't mean they're really inferior in quality. It's just that when your income goes up, you buy less of those things. So that's macaroni and cheese. It's baked potatoes. It's really lame draft beer served in a red Solo cup, right? That's not your world. When GNP goes up 10% and spending goes up, but by less than 10%, we call that a normal good. And that's really not your world either. You're in a very special place that not many goods or services really reside in. And that's called, you're a luxury good. So when income goes up by 10%, spending on foreign travel actually goes up by more than 10%. It tends to go up. Actually, in the United States, foreign travel is a super luxury good. A 10% increase in GNP in this country results in about a 20% increase in spending on foreign travel. So that's a very privileged place to be, so long as the economy is growing, right? And I want to spend a few minutes with you this morning helping you to understand how to forecast or think forward about where GNP is growing, because GNP is so very important to the future of your industry. And you want to be able to make informed decisions, right? Where would our clientele be able to afford to go? Where would they want to go? And things of that nature. Now, the way economists think about GNP when we're trying to forecast it or think forward, how's the economy going to do, is we have this framework, and it's called aggregate supply and aggregate demand. So I'm going to give you a little quick boot camp on that, and I'm sure that you're all clever enough to process this and then be able to use this as you think forward the kinds of programs that you're developing. And the aggregate demand and aggregate supply are going to get together, they're going to do this little dance, and they're going to generate GNP, or aggregate income. Aggregate supply shows the relationship between, let's say, the consumer price index and the aggregate economy-wide amount of goods and services that are brought into production in our society. Typically speaking, when prices are rising, all else the same, firms are interested in producing more goods and services because it's more profitable, right? If prices are going up and costs are staying the same, their revenues are rising, they tend to see this as profitable, and they make more or they provide more goods and services. But there's lots of other things that influence the supply of goods and services aside from the price level. And those other things are really important to have a grasp on, especially given this current administration. So things like, these are other inputs in the production of goods and services, like physical capital, in other words, plant and equipment, human capital, the attributes and abilities embedded in the workforce, technology, know-how, the ability to do various things, raw materials and energy, land, things of that nature. Most of this stuff evolves or grows, but rather slowly. So the supply side of the economy is not typically the cause of abrupt changes in GNP. Most of that is going to be going on the demand side of the economy, and we're going to have a lot to say about that in the next few minutes. Rises in these things will shift out supply and make the economy grow. And given some of the things that the Trump administration has in mind, especially in the energy area, you know, you might expect that aggregate supply is going to be moving out to the right. In addition, his tax policies will have something to do with the aggregate supply curve as well, because if you have greater labor brought to bear, more people wanting to work, that can also increase aggregate supply. And that can happen pretty rapidly, whereas all these other things, capital, technology, those evolve very slowly. Now, the demand side of the economy, where all the volatility is, really comes from four different kinds of expenditures, which are really four different groups of players in the game, right? One of those is consumption, and that's typically spending by households on goods and services. Another is spending on plant and equipment by firms. We call that investment. That is the most volatile form of spending in the economy. Then there's government spending, and of course, there's spending on imports and exports. When we export, that's increasing our demand for goods and services in our society. Now, I have to tell you that in economics, it's more than just understanding that consumption, investment, government, and exports are driving aggregate demand. There's factors going on behind the scenes that are manipulating each of those levels of expenditure, and they're very different. So consumers care about income when deciding how much goods and services to buy. And that's, of course, income is the thing that I'm telling you is the most important driver in your industry, and that's working through consumption spending. Wealth holdings also influence consumption spending when stock prices are going up and when bond values are rising and when people hold more wealth, they tend to consume more. Investment in plant and equipment is not only volatile, but it depends a lot on perceptions. It's really driven by two things: the cost of borrowing money that firms need to spend on plant and equipment, called the interest rate, and it also depends on expected profits. And expected profits depends on firms looking out into the future and thinking, what do my revenue prospects look like? What do my costs look like? Government spending depends on events, politics, things of that nature. And of course, exports depend on tastes and preferences for foreign goods and services, tastes and preferences foreigners have for our goods and services, and also the values of currencies. Let me just say something very quickly here about aggregate demand, because this is going to be important for you to have a grasp on if you want to understand where the economy is going and where your industry is likely to go. When, at any price, when consumption is going up, consumption spending, when investment spending is going up, when governments are spending more, when exports are going up, the demand curve, the aggregate demand curve, is shifting out, and that's going to grow the economy. Okay? That's a really important thing to make sure that you have a grasp of. Okay, so what are we going to do? We're going to put that aggregate supply curve together with that aggregate demand curve, and they'll generate the level of GNP or economic activity in the country. And then the question is, what do you think is going to happen to this? Is demand going to be rising, in which case the economy will grow? Is supply going to be rising, in which case the economy is going to grow? Or are these things going to be contracting? And what are the factors that influence that? And you actually need to be looking forward as you plan your programs and as you plan how you service things in this industry to see what might be happening. And it's important also to recognize that changes in demand and supply, although they can both lead to growth, have differential effects on the price level. So when aggregate demand is growing, the economy is increasing, but prices are rising. When aggregate supply is increasing, the economy is expanding, it's getting bigger, but prices are falling. And of course, you could have both of these things going on simultaneously. Now, given, you know, now we're ready to cut really to the chase, right? You've sort of finished the boot camp, and now we're going to get to the place where most of you have probably been scratching your head recently and going, Trump, my business, where is all this going, right? What does the future look like? Trump and travel, right? And of course, it's Trump, travel, and GNP, because income is the big factor that, by and large, is governing where your industry is going. Now, asking you to be able to predict GNP, that's not such an easy thing for anybody to do. But I do think that once you understand demand and supply at an aggregate level, you can at least be informed in thinking about where your industry might be going. But, you know, recognize that predicting things is not an exact science, especially GNP. So I want to give you two examples of how this can go a bit awry. I think most of you that are older would remember the Hunt boys, right? Their dad, Lamar, started the American, was one of the founders of the American Football Conference, the old AFL, Joe Namath and all that. They were the wealthiest family in America. Back when inflation was starting to heat up in this country, the Hunt boys got this idea, which is, well, dollars are not worth as much as they used to be, so let's get out of dollars and we'll go into bullion. We'll hold silver. And when they started buying silver, it was $5 an ounce, and they started, their advisors told them, yeah, let's hold silver. And they were buying silver and driving up the price, and yeah, it went up to $55 an ounce. But somewhere along the line, the Federal Reserve got the idea that inflation wasn't such a good thing either, and they started to slow the economy down, and inflation came down, and the Hunt boys lost a cool $1 billion trying to corner the market on silver. People said at the time, who would have thought it, right? Well, it's not so easy to predict GNP. You might recognize some of these characters. One of those is John Gruden there in the middle. Chris Collinsworth, the Boomer, they get paid to talk to people about who's going to win football games. The truth is, any of you in here who could flip a coin could predict as well as them, right? It's not so easy to predict things. But at least I've given you a foundation so that you can think about where GNP might be going. So, if we're going to talk about Trumponomics, I think there's two words that we have to keep in mind here. Tax cuts, right? Tax cuts. So lower income taxes are going to drive up disposable income. Disposable income promotes spending, especially on luxury goods like foreign travel. And the other thing is tax cuts promote work. So if I work 1 hour and I make $10 and I face a 30% tax rate, I bring home $7. That might disincentivize work. But if I work an hour and the tax rate is only 10%, I'm bringing home $9. And therefore, I might be inspired to go ahead and work more. Well, Donald Trump has said that his goal is to push through changes in tax legislation. We're going to go from, according to his plan, we're going to go from 7 tax brackets, which is what we have now, to 3. And across the board in virtually every one of those tax brackets, the tax rate is going to be not lower, dramatically lower, right? So you should be expecting, if you're watching this in the next few months, if he gets his way and there's that kind of tax cuts, you would expect that consumption is going to rise, especially to go on foreign travel experiences, right? Maybe I should have said 3 words, more tax cuts, right? Because Trump has proposed that, he said that he's going to cut the business tax, which is about 35% right now on profits, to 15%. He's going to do that on any kind of income that firms earn. That's going to lead to greater profit expectations. Firms are going to want to expand. They're going to spend money on plant and equipment. That's going to drive up aggregate demand in the same way that tax cuts on income are going to drive up aggregate demand. On top of that, when firm profitability looks better, folks want to hold pieces of firms. That's what owning stock is. You can see what's going on in anticipation of these kinds of tax cuts. The stock market has just taken off, right? In the last few weeks, it's grown tremendously to very, very high levels. When stocks and bonds are appreciating in value, when people's wealth position, their financial wealth position is improving, they spend money on consumption goods. That's called the Pigou effect. It was the economist that discovered that. In my profession, anytime you come up with a new idea, you name it after yourself, right? So the Pigou effect, that's driving aggregate demand up. So there's two reasons why you would expect the economy to be expanding here in the near term is we're expecting income tax cuts and we're expecting profit tax cuts, right? Both of those. There's more tax cuts that he has in mind. Right now, there's a lot of wealth that is just cold stored around the world that would kind of like to walk itself back to the United States. This is wealth made by American businesses and American workers that they earned overseas. And facing that 35% tax, they've just left it there in bank accounts, right? And Trump has argued that he's going to cut that rate to 10% to try to repatriate, if you like, all this foreign wealth that's held by American citizens. And if he does that, there's going to be a huge flow of that wealth back into the United States. And when that wealth comes back in, it's going to promote consumption spending. So that's another factor that would be driving the demand curve up, right? Actually, I should have said 4 words. Yep, more tax cuts. Trump has said that he's going to get rid of the estate tax, or what he calls it the death tax. The estate tax is the tax on wealth when you pass away that isn't left to your spouse. There's rules and regulations on all this. There's an entire industry on setting up estates for tax avoidance, but I just made you a quick little table there to show you what the typical tax schedule looks like on estates. So an estate of $1 million, there's about $345,000 in taxes that's picked up at probate, right? He's argued that he's going to eliminate completely the estate tax. That would mean that there's a lot of additional wealth, and I think some of those people would celebrate by traveling overseas, right? So aggregate demand will be going up, and you'll be getting more of your share of that. Oh, gosh, more tax cuts, right? A lot of business entities, and you probably feel this way too, that a lot of the regulations you face are essentially a tax on your energies and your endeavors. And Trump has argued that he is going to eliminate, slash dramatically, all kinds of corporate regulations. He said 75%. I mean, nobody knows exactly what that means, but he is certainly interested in cutting down on a lot of regulatory costs. And he's focused a lot of his talk about this on the energy industry. And of course, energy is a key input in all kinds of productive processes. It has a lot to do with the supply of goods and services that we generate. But if he does that, you would probably see both supply rising and also consumer spending go up, because as regulatory taxes go down, companies become more profitable, and the stocks that people own become more valuable, and the market would rise even more. I can't leave this topic of tax cuts without saying something about the border tax. So you need to know something about the United States. We're a very rich nation. And because we're rich, we import lots of things, whether it's a beautiful bottle of wine or cheeses or Italian handbags or cameras from Germany and Japan, et cetera. So we tend to run what's called a current account deficit. Now, this has been treated as the devil in the last few weeks and months. But what that means is that we import so much that more dollars are flowing out than the amount of goods and services exports that we have, which is bringing dollars back, right? So we run a current account deficit. We do that with Mexico. We do that with China and many other countries. Now, those dollars don't park and never come back, right? It is true that we've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs in the last two decades, right? That's due to comparative advantage. We are way better at doing things like setting up travel than we are at making toaster ovens, right? So we let China make toaster ovens and send them to Walmart, and we buy them there at low prices. Yep. And we do other kinds of things like provide financial services and things of that nature. So those dollars come back through the capital accounts. So the dollars going out actually come back. It's just who benefits from these things. Our financial industry has benefited tremendously. We have lots of jobs in that sector. Every student at my university wants to manage somebody's money, right? That's what they do. I haven't had a student at Washington, Lee, since I arrived there from teaching many years at UNC Chapel Hill, that ever said things like, I really want to make toaster ovens. That's just not what they want to do, right? So we run a current account deficit, and we run a capital account surplus. We have lots more jobs in the financial sector and fewer jobs in manufacturing. Now, the border tax. When you say, I'm going to tax goods and services coming in from countries where we have a current account deficit, right? That's going to be not just taxes on Mexico. That would be taxes on China, right? And that the idea is by taxing those goods and services coming in, it would incentivize U.S. firms to build manufacturing plants in the United States, which would certainly improve or expand our level of economic activity, right? But you have to be aware of two things here. One, that's positive for your industry, if we stop buying things from as many things from China and Mexico, the demand for the peso is going to fall, and the value of the peso will fall, which means the dollar will immediately become relatively stronger, and more people will want to go on your trips. Well, the other thing is that they're not just going to get in the corner and ball up and cry or show their belly, roll over on the ground and show their belly. They're probably going to slap a 20% tax on American goods and services that we export, right? That will be involved in a trade war. And what we'll be doing at that point is not taking advantage of comparative advantage, which seems like a kind of a silly thing, right? I don't know where this is actually all going to go, but I can assure you that whether we have a tax war, in which case U.S. exports will fall, or we tax them and they don't tax us and the value of their currency falls, makes our currency stronger, right? Well, when our currency becomes stronger, U.S. exports fall because our goods look relatively expensive to them. So exports are going to be probably a drag on our economy a little bit in the near term. Now, how much of a drag? Probably less than all those other increases in expenditures we've been talking about. Before we sum all this up, I do want to say that governments do more than cut taxes, right? They also spend. And President Trump has made it very clear that he wants to spend a lot on infrastructure. He loves to talk about how lame our airports are compared to airports that he goes to throughout the world. Okay? So maybe we'll have a lot of spending on airports. Defense spending, he wants to increase defense spending. And he's talked a little bit about curtailing some social spending. But on the whole, it looks like he's talking about spending more, not less, in aggregate. So this is, you know, what I had mentioned a moment ago, with the border tax. So let's sum all of this up. What do we think is going to happen? With all those tax cuts on consumers and firms, you would expect aggregate demand to be pushing way out. And with all the government spending he's talking about, those three factors are going to dramatically dominate any drag that exports have. So we would expect the aggregate demand curve to be moving out to the right. At the same time, with cutting income taxes, you're going to see a flood of increase in labor supply and cutting all kinds of regulatory phenomena. You would expect aggregate supply to also shift to the right. So if you were a betting person, you would say the economy is going to grow, right? And that's what he promised, right, when he ran for president, that the economy would grow. Okay? But the real question is that sustainable, or is this really a house of cards? So let's think about this for a second. When governments run budget deficits, when they spend more than their tax revenue, they still have to pay their bills. So what they do is they borrow money. They borrow the difference. Now, to inspire folks to save and lend to them, they have to offer higher and higher interest rates. Higher interest rates are a drag on the economy in two ways. First, higher interest rates deter consumers from spending on big-ticket items, you know, sailboats, washer-dryers, cars, houses, right? In my community, horses, right? Higher interest rates deter firms from spending on plant and equipment because the cost of borrowing the money that they then use to spend to expand their businesses, that cost has gone up. Now, as a result, right, that can be a real drag on the level of the economy over time. Those higher interest rates won't show up immediately. That would happen down the road. Now, it just so happens, and you're going to hear this conversation, is that the people that are offering him advice are going to say, no. The government is not going to run budget deficits if all of the things that President Trump is proposing come to fruition. They'll actually run budget surpluses. They'll take in so much tax revenue that they'll end up borrowing less, not more. That'll drop the interest rate and the economy will expand even more. Now, I got to tell you, there's only one person that's been president in the last 50 years that ran budget surpluses, and that was Bill Clinton, right? He actually presided over 9 straight years of budget surpluses, and he takes full credit for that. But the bottom line is he was in the right place at the right time. You know, he was there when technology really boomed, the internet developed and things of that. And it really wasn't discovered by Al Gore, right? Now, a lot of congressional Republicans who historically have complained about budget deficit spending, in fact, my Republican friends for the last 50 years have been complaining relentlessly. In the last 8 years, they complained all of the time about Obama and budget deficits. And when you say to them, it looks like Trump is going to run some really big budget deficits, they go, no. We're going to actually run budget surpluses. So here's the way the story works. Imagine an economy that taxes at 30% and the economy has a size of 10. There's $3 in tax revenue. They go, by cutting all these tax rates to, let's say, 20%, the economy is going to boom so much it's going to be a value not of 10, of 20. And 20% of 20 is $4 in tax revenue, and that's more than 30% of 10. Well, yeah, I mean, that's simple addition and subtraction, you know. But the real question is, you really think that's going to happen? That's kind of a roll of the dice. So, you know, here's a little picture over there for you. And I'm going to say we've heard this story before. We heard this story from Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan said, I'm going to cut the number of tax brackets. I'm going to cut the income tax rate. I'm going to get rid of all kinds of government regulations. The economy is going to boom and tax revenue is going to flourish. And what you see there is that during the Reagan years, we ran huge budget deficits every single year. And in fact, the United States went from the world's largest creditor, we were lending other countries around the world money, to the world's biggest debtor during the Reagan years. We started borrowing lots of money. So there's a, you know, we have to be thoughtful and take a look at what might actually be going on, right? Because that's going to slow the economy down, to say the least. Now, the U.S. Federal Reserve is watching all of this, too, and they're involved in the game. Before Trump got elected, Janet Yellen and the Fed said, during 2017, we're probably going to bump the interest rate up probably an eighth of a point, three times at least, in 2017. Well, if the Trump gets his way and we have all these massive tax cuts and all these increases in spending, she'll probably bump the interest rate up a bunch of times to try to slow the economy down a little bit because she doesn't want it to get inflationary. So either Trump's budget deficits a few years down the road will slow the economy down, or the Fed will slow the economy down. But in the near term, it really looks like it's going to expand. Now, there's one last thing I want to talk to you about, and then we can throw this open to an interesting and interactive conversation. And that is, nothing can kill an economy like uncertainty. What happens when there's uncertainty is everybody runs to liquidity, which means they don't spend. So when households are a little jittery about the future, they save more and consume less. Not good for you, right? When firms are worried about the future, they save more and they spend less on plant and equipment. Both of those things will slow aggregate demand down and slow the economy down. Not good for you. So where does that economic uncertainty come from? It comes from things like saying, I think we're going to have a border tax, right? Because no one really knows, like, are we just going to tax Mexico? Are we going to tax China? You know, are we going to get into trade wars? There's a lot of uncertainty with that. In addition, there's a lot of social uncertainty that may play itself out in the next few years. The kind of tax cuts that President Trump is suggesting that he's going to advance will lead to a massive increase in inequality. And when there's a lot of inequality, you can get social unrest and feelings that that there's social tension because of social justice issues. And in that kind of environment, firms are less likely to spend on plant and equipment, which will slow the economy down, and households be less likely to spend unless they're spending on going to Washington for a march, right? So you may see a lot of social uncertainty and economic uncertainty just kind of put the brakes on the economy. And this is critically important to the travel industry because your industry is highly, highly sensitive to income, right? That's you know, what I was showing you early on. So I'm going to stop there and just say thank you for inviting me, and I hope you benefited from this in some ways.
Art, thank you so much. I think we not only got an opportunity for a university-level economics class, but you laid a great groundwork for all of the questions. I think I started off with thinking, oh, this is great. There's all these tax cuts. Oh, no, we ended with all of the uncertainty, and we only covered the economic uncertainty. So I'd love to open it up for questions, answers, thoughts on the economic standpoint, but also on the political, on the social, and various other factors that are playing a role in decisions to travel. This, just by the way, as we go around the room and we do kind of open it up, please remember this is a recorded session, so those of our colleagues haven't had a chance to see this or be in the room, they'll be able to look back on this session and really hear it. So do include your name and your organization when we go around. So where do we begin? Who has a question on, pressing question on, where are we going? I'll come around a little bit. Does this leave everybody in a state of shock? Are we in a place of, I just don't know where to go from here? I'll start here with Joe, and then I'll come
here. Yeah, well, thank you very much. That was very informative. And I have to say that after several decades of being in this business, it's certainly true that you realize that you can do lots of things right, and you have to really focus, I think, on what you need to do right to be set up in the best possible way. But there's lots of events and things that are going to happen outside in the real world that are way beyond your control, and so you have to be adaptive. And I kind of miss those days. Just, you made me reminisce a little bit back to the days before the euro, when it was great and you could plan. You know, Greece was having a weak drachma. You could plan a trip there and have real value. And of course, the Eurozone kind of messed that up, although England's coming back. And you do see, another thing I wanted to mention is our timeline, I think, is very long. We have, we are already out pretty much sold for 2018, and, we're starting to plan 2019. So we plan very far out in advance, and most of us market really far in advance, too, maybe 9 months before a trip operates. So there's always lots of things that happen that are kind of beyond your control. So from tour operator's point of view, I think it's always important that we're kind of flexible and adaptive to the environment. Yeah. But you do see slowly, like you see when France, for instance, gets into some perceived safety issues, that you suddenly see people going more to Ireland or more to Australia or, moving to these different destinations. And so that is, you do see the kind of dynamics you were talking about in the real world happening all the time.
For sure.
Right now, I kind of see it as, we have kind of really strong dollar. We have a really booming stock market. We have a really high consumer confidence rate relative to where it's been in recent years. So we have all these really great positives kind of standing up against this uncertainty that people have. And of course, mostly I think we like, most businesses like steady as she goes, kind of predictability. And we're certainly far from that. And I guess I'm not sure what my question is at the end, but I just wanted to point out a few of those things that I think you touched on that really are powerful dynamics that we have to deal with.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe. I'll just say one thing about that. There's optimism generates optimism, and pessimism generates pessimism. And you're right. I mean, we're just on a roll right now in terms of the way people are feeling about the U.S. economy. And that's probably going to continue for some time. But I will say that when it flips, and things do make, for adjustments, right? If we get to that place where all of a sudden these economic and social uncertainties start to play themselves out, it can go the other way very, very quickly. The train can get off the tracks. And, I don't know enough about how you all hedge in your industry, but you're right to think that even though you're planning out a few years, you really need to be hyper alert to where that's going. You know, in the industry that I'm in, you know, I taught for many years at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and that was a university that was very sensitive to the economic status of the taxpayers and their families in North Carolina. And we were hyper sensitive to where that was going because it really influenced our applications and so forth. Now I work at Washington and Lee, and there's nothing in the world that's going to reduce the fact that we get 6,500 applications a year to admit 700 kids, and 400 are going to come, right? I mean, we just have this very, very loyal fan base, right? Maybe for some of the things that Peter was saying, but they're not that sensitive to the economic situation. Our financial aid packages are, but your industry, I would think that you need to be very cognizant and watch for when those changes can occur and think a lot about how you can hedge some of that to make it a viable and sustainable business.
And Art, you bring up a great point. We're talking a lot about uncertainty as it relates to where we fall financially, and yet there's all the other variables that we haven't even tackled from terrorism, which I think is really top of mind for everybody. So it'd be great to, you know, add that type of conversation into our realities and where do we go from there. And I know you had a question as well.
Yes, Chris Bensley from Holbrook Travel. And my question has to do with, at a time where we are, you know, ironically stronger than ever and unemployment is low, and we bring in a new president that's going to drive demand, assuming this happens, and I'm not speaking about all the other uncertainties. I mean, we always, you know, in the travel business know that anything can happen. But one of the biggest motivators, aside from all of that, is the strength of the dollar. Oh, and we've seen that recently with the UK. I guess two questions, which is, what is this increased demand, assuming it happens, going to do with the dollar, with all these other countries that we travel to? And then the other thing is, you didn't mention inflation, and I wonder if that has any factor in this.
Sure. So let's talk about inflation first. The media has done a lot of disservice over the years when it talks about inflation because they're very confused about it. I've seen probably 100 reports where someone will get on TV and say things like, the price of steel went up last quarter, driving inflation. No. Inflation is a general rise in the entire price index, the basket of all the things that we buy. So when is there inflation? There's inflation when demand is really ratcheted up and supply is unable to grow fast enough to meet that. So can you get the bellows going enough on that fire to create some inflation? One of the things that's kept inflation really tamped down in recent years is globalization. How can you start charging much higher prices when everywhere you look, somebody else around the world is providing similar products, right? That's not going to change. But it is indeed the case that with all the kinds of tax cuts that Trump is talking about, if we implement all those, there can be some inflationary pressures. On the other hand, Janet Yellen, who is the head of the Federal Reserve right now, she is a very steady, thoughtful, guiding hand. And I think everybody believes that, a lot like Bernanke, she will, you know, she has her pulse on this and won't let inflation get wildly out of control. So I don't think inflation is going to be a big concern. Now, the value of the dollar, that, you know, that's an interesting question, right? Because as our incomes go up in the next 2 years, and they're rising, right? We're going to be buying a lot of imported goods, which is driving everybody else's currency up, right? So I don't see a situation where the dollar is going to become, I would say, either dramatically stronger or dramatically weaker. There's forces going in both directions, right? The higher interest rates will strengthen the dollar, but then we have so much income, we're buying so much stuff, that's strengthening their currency, and you're getting sort of an equalization. Right now, the dollar is very strong. It's a good time to travel.
Joan Russell, World Affairs Council, and Karen, I think, wanted to look at perhaps some of the political situations. Yeah. So Cuba had a special period in the late 90s. They lost 85% of their economy when the Soviet Union collapsed.
Yeah.
Venezuela came in and similarly collapsed. Yeah. So that's one example of a place where a lot of our travelers go.
Yeah.
Iran is having, you know, a seesaw between the Ayatollah and the Republican Guard and President Rouhani. So, you know, we get, okay, visas are going to be issued, visas aren't going to be issued, so another unstable area for us. Baltic Cruise, we had a speaker from the RAND Corporation who had this wonderful PowerPoint, but to me it looked like something out of World War II. There were sort of these sweeping red lines, and that was Russia. NATO was in disarray, and so on and so on. The other area, of course, is Eastern Europe, and a lot of us have programs there.
Yeah.
So Romania, they have massive protests right now because of corruption. You know, I think other countries there, Bulgaria, Poland, are having their it moving to the right. And, you know, we're sort of asked, well, you know, go to South America, Australia, New Zealand, which is going to be a pretty narrow window for a lot of us.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you can link world economies, U.S. Travelers' intention, given that we're talking about, you know, I mean, the wealth is not something that is going to be risked by the people who have the wealth. So I wonder if you can just address that somewhat.
Sure.
Sorry.
I'll start by saying that I certainly believe that countries all over around the world have a strong sense of what is in their best interest, right? They're not foolish. And travel is one of the most remarkable things that you can use as an export good, right? So if you're Egypt and you can get people to come here and visit the pyramids, that's a great resource that you can sell, export to the world. And it's not going to run out, right? It's not like, well, what we're going to do is we're going to mine bauxite, right? And then one day, there's no bauxite left, right? Now, we're in a crazy situation right now, frankly, where countries all over the world that have these amazing resources that people would like to travel and visit and see are in such an insecure place, and there's such political diversity, right, and tumult, that you might not feel comfortable going to Venezuela, right, and Argentina, and Brazil, and Iran, and so forth, right? What a shame, right? What a shame. And you got to figure that ultimately, in the next few years, that these societies will come to the realization that this is a magnificent way to generate wealth and grow, to have a healthy, robust tourism industry, right? And they don't want to cede it all to places that, as you pointed out, are narrow, right? Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Iceland, right? So in my heart of hearts, I think that just economic incentives will inspire a lot of these governments and countries around the world to come to their senses and partner up and cooperate and become stable again. And we're just in, you know, we're in a period where we've had a lot of active terrorism, right? And I think countries are just trying to figure out how do we respond to all of this. But they know they're losing, right? And if they start losing your industry, the pressures will become even more intense for them to figure out how to solve these various problems. Cuba, I mean, Rob and Susie can speak to this more. Because they just ran a trip to Cuba, and I know our alums desperately want to go there. And of course, why wouldn't they want to go there, right? So the question is, how can your industry make that, partner with governments, make that a growth industry for their countries, right? It seems like common sense will rule the day eventually, but right now there's a lot of uncertainty, right? Yeah, it's really...
Definitely a lot of uncertainty and a lot of question, and people are sort of trying to figure out how do we navigate these waters. We have time for a few questions and just a couple more, and we haven't covered this side of the room. So if there's anyone here that would like to ask something or address something that they know relates specifically to their travel program or where do we go from here, then that's great. Well, then I think what we're going to do is, if we don't have anything more immediately, then I think what we'll do is take a moment, recognize that, Art, you have a wealth of information. You present probably more questions than answers,
true.
But that's good because it gives us food for thought. It gives us a chance to recognize that there's so much we can learn out there. I know, Art, you'll be here for a little while
absolutely.
Afterwards.
Yep.
So those that have some more questions and would like to address them, Art can't necessarily predict tea leaves or have a crystal ball, but you definitely have laid the groundwork for us and helped us just begin to put some context into our next steps and where we're going for our own travel programs. So I'd like to take a moment and first of all thank Art for
thank
your
you.
Great, great
thank
presentation.
You.
Thanks
thank
everybody.
You. Thank you.
Thank you also to Joe Small and to Joan Russell for their perspective. Thanks to all of you for your insight and for being here today. And, of course, Rob Fury at Washington & Lee for having the vision for a concept like this, since it's a different angle of a session than we generally have. So thank you all for being here. Take the time to fill out the evaluation. Have a great rest of the conference. Thank you.